Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, April 11th. You know, we don't usually begin this show by saying what kind of mug our guest drinks their coffee in, but in this case we will. Apparently, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, drinks out of a mug that says, F you, Putin, except all the words are spelled out. That was reported first by Business Insider. Maybe you've heard that she also has had bracelets made that say that and gave one to Stephen Colbert on his show. And maybe this is not the kind of diplomacy, if it is diplomacy, we would expect from a distinguished former ambassador who was the picture of dignity when she was a witness at Donald Trump's Ukraine-related impeachment hearings or after Trump fired her in an apparent act of workplace retaliation. But maybe it's private citizen diplomacy that meets the moment. In any case, Marie Yovanovitch, whose family fled both the Soviets and the Nazis in Europe, has written a memoir called Lessons from the Edge. And she certainly has the background to understand what's happening in the Kremlin right now, as well as in Ukraine. She grew up with both Russian and English spoken at home. In college at Princeton, she majored in history and Russian studies. She served on the Russia desk at the State Department under President Clinton. She was senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs under President George W. Bush. All that before being posted to Ukraine and not being a fan of President Trump's attempt to shake down Volodymyr Zelensky to announce a fake investigation of Joe Biden. Remember that? So maybe she's got just the right kind of experience to design the most geopolitically relevant mugs and bracelets of 2022. Ambassador Yovanovitch, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome to WNYC.
It's a pleasure being on.
And we'll get to the mugs and bracelets and the Boris Johnson walking in the streets of Kyiv with President Zelensky yesterday and Russia's apparent new strategy to decimate the eastern part of the country in order to own it. But first, I've read that you place part of the blame for Putin's invasion of Ukraine on Donald Trump, even though he's not president right now. Do I have that right?
Well, I think that when Donald Trump was president, he certainly indicated a lack of respect for Ukraine, shall we say, in that perfect phone call with President Zelensky, where he made it clear that he was holding up our military assistance, the javelins that now everybody knows about. He was holding up that military assistance for a foreign leader to do him a favor, though. And, you know, that kind of undermining of our foreign policy, of our national security interests, you know, once it was made public with the release of the transcript, really was, I think, quite damaging. I think it sent a signal to authoritarian leaders around the world, certainly including Putin, as well as to bad actors, private actors, both in the U.S. and abroad, that they could, you know, they could cut deals with the former administration. We've seen Vladimir Putin where he has over the years invaded Georgia and taken parts of Georgia. In 2014, he did the same in Ukraine. In 2019, he did the same with the Sea of Azov, which is that small little sea right above the Black Sea that is totally encircled by Russia and Ukraine. And that was when Donald Trump was president. And Donald Trump didn't even want to issue a statement saying that the seizure of three Ukrainian vessels by the Russian Navy in international waters was something to be condemned. So I think we've seen a pattern of what Russia has done, but we've also seen a pattern of how Donald Trump has, allowed Putin to get away with it.
And you mentioned that infamous phone call in which Zelensky's asking Trump for weapons to defend against potential further Russian incursions after they seized Crimea in 2014. And Trump says, "Do me a favor, though," as you remembered, and that favor was going to be to announce a fake investigation of the Biden family. And so today, Volodymyr Zelensky is a hero to much of the world. But you tell a story in the book of how during that phone call, Zelensky piled on you and called you a bad ambassador. So how close did Zelensky come, in your opinion, to announcing the fake investigation of the Bidens? And what would you say his relationship with Donald Trump was, resisting or colluding or whatever words you would use?
Yeah, well, just, you know, the first item, you know, sort of how he characterized me. I mean, I think I had a perfectly normal relationship with President Zelensky when I was in Ukraine. At that time, he was about to become a candidate for president and then became a candidate for president. I left before he became president. And we met a number of times. We had a very constructive relationship. I think what you saw or what we saw in the transcript was a new and untested president, Zelensky, talking to his most important partner, the United States, and Donald Trump. And, you know, his mission was to get those javelins signed off by the president, even though, you know, Congress had already approved the transfer of those javelins. And so I think he was playing along with Donald Trump, as we've seen other world leaders do, as we've seen other people in the United States do. So, you know, I don't take these things personally. I don't think they're meant personally. I think we need to remember that. In terms of Zelensky, I mean, what was his relationship with Donald Trump? I mean, I think that was maybe the second or the third phone call. And, you know, he hadn't yet met Donald Trump, but he knew it was important to get a good working relationship with the single most important international partner. And so he was trying to figure out how to do that. But he, you know, he kind of left the question open about the investigations. And then ultimately he did not pursue that path, thank goodness.
Are you surprised at all at the way Zelensky has risen to the occasion during this war, based on your earlier contacts with him when he was a new president?
You know, Zelensky is even when he was candidate, he was a very impressive guy. He's a self-made millionaire through his talent and his hard work. He not only had these, a comedy troupe that toured all over the Russian-speaking world, including in Russia. He was very popular there. He had a great TV series, Servant of the People, and he was really super impressive. And he built this a multi-million-dollar media empire. He had a production company, you know, all through his own hard work and sweat and talent. And he was really proud of that. He wanted people to know that. You know, would I have predicted that life would imitate art and that he became president? No. Would I have predicted that he would become, you know, the Winston Churchill of our time, inspiring, you know, not only the Ukrainian people, but the world? You know, his courage, his communication skills are pretty phenomenal. And I think he is doing an outstanding job of uniting the Ukrainian people and uniting the world against the evil that we are seeing with this Russian invasion of Ukraine.
The Winston Churchill of our time. Those are pretty big words.
And I think they're appropriate.
Segueing to the current leader of the UK, I assume you saw Boris Johnson walking in the street in Ukraine and Kyiv with Zelensky over the weekend. Here's a clip of Boris Johnson from that moment.
Together with friends and partners, we, the UK and others, supply the equipment, the technology, the know-how, the intelligence, so that Ukraine will never be invaded again.
A promise for the future. Before we talk about Boris Johnson, Ambassador, was that a kind of victory lap for Zelensky, maybe, and the West, after Russia withdrew from around the capital city of Kyiv, even though we saw the horrors of the kinds of murders that they left behind?
Well, I am an optimist, but I think it's too early to talk about victory. The Ukrainian military, with its prowess and with Western training and equipment, was able to battle back Russian forces and cause them to withdraw to Russia and to Belarus. But what they're doing there is they're regrouping, they're rearming, and they're repositioning. And they're repositioning in that part of eastern Ukraine known as the Donbas, part of which is already occupied by Russia. And, you know, what our military experts are saying and what our national security experts are saying is that we need to brace, Ukraine needs to brace for a very, very large land battle in that part of Ukraine. And it is going to be bloody, and it is going to be, I think, really, really difficult. I think you've probably already heard, or your listeners have heard, that the Russians have named a new military commander who is known as the Butcher of Syria for his actions in Syria. And so I think that, you know, when we think about Bucha and Mariupol, I fear that perhaps this general will bring to Ukrainians more of the same. Yeah. So it is absolutely imperative that the U.S. keep on supplying and our allies keep on supplying Ukraine so that they can push the Russians back.
And I want to ask you more about what may be coming in the East. But just before we get off Zelensky and Boris Johnson, one of those two mm-hmm. men wants to be part of the EU. The other made history by leaving the EU in Brexit, with social media help from Russia. In fact, last month, Boris Johnson gave a speech in the UK, widely criticized, in which he compared the Ukrainians' desire to identify with Europe to his desire to not. Listen.
And I know that it's the instinct of the people of this country, like the people of Ukraine, to choose freedom every time. I can give you a couple of famous recent examples. When the British people voted for Brexit in such large numbers, I don't believe it was because they were remotely hostile to foreigners. It's because they wanted to be free.
Ambassador Yovanovitch, do you want to pile on and say anything about that comparison?
I hadn't heard that before, and of course, I don't know the context around those words, but I would say that I think that part of the reason Ukrainians want to join the EU is for the freedom and the greater opportunity that joining one of the largest economic associations would bring to Ukraine and Ukrainians. And, you know, this has been something Ukrainians have wanted for a number of years. And every year that Putin sponsors malign activities in Ukraine, the number of people in Ukraine who want to join the EU goes up. I think the last figure I saw was something like over 90%. So this is an all-of-country desire. And I think we saw the EU leadership in Ukraine a couple of days ago, in Kyiv actually, a couple of days ago, you know, sort of presenting President Zelensky with the application form and indicating, I think, that it could be fast-tracked. We'll have to see how fast fast-track is. But I think that's a good sign overall.
What's the difference in terms of what it would mean for Ukraine or what the admission requirements are for Ukraine to join the EU as compared with joining NATO?
Well, the EU is more of an economic association, and certainly that is, I think, what the Ukrainians are most interested in. It's also become more recently over the years a political association as well. So in theory, at least, there's a united foreign policy, although that's more in theory really than in practice. NATO is a defensive pact. It's a military alliance based on common values, and it's a defense pact. And so it's a very different kind of an organization, even though the member countries of the EU and NATO often overlap.
Beth, on the Lower East Side, you're on WNYC. Hi, Beth.
Oh, hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. And my question is this. It seems like now with Russia apparently starting to refocus its energies to the eastern part of the country. It seems like, at least my understanding is that in the Donbass and the Crimea regions, that there's more pro-Russian sentiment. And how strong will the resistance be against Russians going further into those regions, if from your sense?
Well, thanks. Thanks for the kind words, Beth, and thanks for the question as well. It is true that in the East and in the South as well, there are more Russian speakers, perhaps more of Russian heritage. But that doesn't mean that they aren't Ukrainian patriots. And even if there was some sympathy towards Russia before, even after the taking of Crimea, the illegal annexation in 2014, and the attacks in the Donbass in 2014-2015, even if there was still some sympathy there, I think I'm pretty positive that right now there is none. Because the Russians are invading the country. They are raining terror on civilians. They're killing children. They're destroying homes and hospitals, daycare centers. And, I just don't think there is any sympathy left for Russia in any part of Ukraine. It's the irony that Putin's actions have caused the exact opposite of what he wanted. I mean, if what he wanted was to, bring Ukraine into the fold of, the Russian Empire, what he is getting is the greatest resistance he has ever encountered. And that will continue. You know, if he wanted to weaken NATO and weaken the West, he has solidified, the NATO alliance as well as Western unity. So, I mean, the list kind of goes on that this was a huge miscalculation, I think, for Putin. And the Ukrainian people are going to fight back, and they will continue to fight back.
And you think even in the Donbass region, which had Russian separatists, that was the big story from that region as far as the West was concerned before the invasion?
I know that we often call them Russian separatists, but actually what it was Russian-controlled, Russian proxies in eastern Ukraine. There wasn't a kind of an indigenous sort of spontaneous desire to leave Ukraine in the east. The Russian military came in. They sent in mercenaries. They hired locals that they controlled and that they continued to control. I mean, Russian citizens were the heads of the two little statelets that Russia created, in the Donbass, the LNR and the DNR. And so there was nothing kind of spontaneous about it. It was all Russian controlled and continues to be.
Well, maybe now is the appropriate time to ask you about those mugs and bracelets that say F.U. Putin with the F word spelled out. I still have a hard time connecting that kind of thing with the dignified diplomat that I saw in the impeachment hearings, that Marie Ivanovich, or the dignified ex-diplomat who's been speaking to us this morning. So how did you come to get those things made?
Well, it was actually a gift to me by one of the cabinet members in the Ukrainian government back when I first arrived. And, it's kind of sort of shocking and funny all at the same time. And, one of my visitors noticed it it's very discreet, very small, teeny little letters. But one of my visitors noticed it. And since, visitors from Washington, as they come to Poland, Ukraine now, they are all about showing support for Ukraine and showing resistance to Russia's malign activities, the war that Russia was continuing to perpetrate, the reinvasion that Russia is perpetrating now. And so I gave it away. And so then I had to get another one. And then I, started getting more, and it was subtle and it was private and it was sort of, kind of a shocker. But it made a point. It was only after I retired from the Foreign Service, that I made it a little bit more public. I like to think of it, not that I'm comparing myself to the great Madeleine Albright, but she had that great collection of pins And mm-hmm. And she communicated through those pens to world dictators and others. And she communicated the things that maybe she couldn't say verbally. And so I like to think that maybe I'm in that same tradition.
Yeah. Well, on communicating that message in any way, we had Gideon Rose from Foreign Affairs Magazine and the Council on Foreign Relations on the show last week, and he said, I'm paraphrasing, but the gist was the way to get Putin to stop the murderous war in Ukraine is not to drag his reputation through the mud publicly at every turn, but to give him a way to withdraw with some kind of face saving. Otherwise, he'll continue the missile attacks on children's theaters and train stations and everything else. Does Gideon Rose have a point?
I think that we have been trying to do that. Before the war, you'll recall that there were no sanctions levied against Russia. It was just, you know, if you do this, we are very serious about the measures that will be imposed. As you'll recall, back in January, there were three separate meetings with the Russians that that we conducted, trying to persuade them that this is not the right path. Russia had sent us those two treaties, one to NATO, one to the United States, back in December. And in January, we responded in writing, and it was a serious and a substantive response to the concerns that Russia laid out. Probably wasn't everything that Russia wanted, but that's the nature of negotiations, whether it's in business or diplomacy. You know, you sit down and you kind of work these things out. Russia wasn't interested. Russia thought that that they were going to, you know, just march into Kyiv. They would be greeted as victors and as liberators, and it would all be fine, and that they didn't need, kind of an off-ramp, as we sometimes call it, because they could have it all. And they found out that that is not the case. So, as you know, negotiations do continue. I mean, Zelensky has said publicly it's harder as they're finding out about these atrocities that have been committed. Sure. But he has to think about the future of Ukraine. He has to think about the whole country. And so, yes, they are going to continue to negotiate with the Russians. But I think what we're seeing, and you know, Zelensky has put a lot on the table. He has said, you know, non-NATO status, that they would be a neutral country, et cetera. He's put a lot on the table for the Russians to chew over, things that they have said that they want. And yet what we're seeing is continued attacks from Russia. And it's my view, and I think the view of many analysts, that Russia wants to change the facts on the ground. The military campaign has not been going very well for Russia so far. They want to change that. And they want to force concessions, greater concessions, from Ukraine. So the thing about providing, a way out for Putin and everything, I think a lot of great minds are thinking about that, but Putin isn't ready. You know, timing in diplomacy is the same as timing in life. I mean, it's really important. And the Russians are just not ready to negotiate seriously yet.
Let me ask you about Trump's later Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who was your boss when you were posted to Ukraine, and he famously did not defend you when Trump was publicly smearing you. You write about this in the book. And Pompeo, shockingly, or maybe I shouldn't be shocked, but shockingly to my ears, Pompeo defended Putin recently, just as the war was beginning, maybe 6 weeks ago, praising Putin like this.
He's a very talented statesman. He has lots of gifts. He was a KGB agent, for goodness sakes. He knows how to use power. We should respect that.
Ambassador, did that shock you or not so much?
Well, at a time when Putin, I think he said that right prior to the invasion, Russian forces had encircled. Yeah, exactly. Had encircled Ukraine on three sides. And, it was clear what was coming next. And then the invasion did start. I mean, it is never right to give succor to authoritarian leaders. Never.
So what are the implications, in your opinion, considering this war, if Trump or Pompeo or someone from that camp gets elected president in 2024?
I'm an optimist. And so I hope that we are going to have a leader in the White House who believes in alliances, understands the threat that authoritarian, not to say totalitarian, regimes pose, not just to Ukraine, but to the United States and the free world, and understand the importance of upholding the international rules-based system that was established after World War II and has kept us more secure, more prosperous, and more free ever since World War II.
Kind of to that point, listener on Twitter writes, does the ambassador believe there is any silver lining for the Western world and democracy generally in this horrible conflict?
I think the silver lining is that while there have been wake-up calls over the last decade or so, I think now, the alarm is truly being rung, and I think world leaders are hearing it. And the challenge is going to be, focusing on not just the immediate and the next couple of months, but how do we deal with the issues and the challenges and the problems of the 21st century? How do we adjust our institutions and our norms? How do we stay united? And how do we keep the focus on keeping ensuring that we are, again, more free, more prosperous, and more secure?
Former Ambassador Marie Ivanovich, now a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a non-resident fellow at Georgetown University, and the author of her new memoir, which is called Lessons from the Edge. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us and your experience. We really, really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.